Scott Pruitt faces scrutiny for an array of possible ethics violations at the EPA, but the president isn't ready to say his catchphrase.
You're going to be reluctant to fire the guy who is most effectively carrying out your agenda, even if he's got ethical issues on the margins.
Also, belated recognition for an African-American woman who rode her Harley on the streets of Miami and across the Jim Crow South.
She believed in the Southern manners, a lady with her hair whipping through the wind underneath her helmet.
And you told us about the women that you think have been overlooked.
I would vote for Emma Goldman, anarchist and general purveyor of civil disobedience.
And a look at crime and massive school closures in Puerto Rico. This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, April 10th, 2018.
I just heard that they broke into the office of one of my personal attorneys, good man.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to be with you today. President Donald Trump gathered military commanders and national security advisors to the White House on Monday. They were all there to mull options for striking Syria after an alleged chemical attack there. But with the press gathered for the photo op, the president had another issue on his mind. Earlier that day, the FBI raided an office and hotel room of his longtime personal attorney, Michael Cohen.
I have this witch hunt constantly going on for over 12 months now, and actually much more than that. You could say it was right after I won the nomination it started. And it's a disgrace. It's frankly a real disgrace. It's an attack on our country in a true sense.
Now, it's important to note here that the U.S. attorney in New York who got the warrant for the search is one of President Trump's own appointees. And so is the head of the FBI, which conducted that raid on Michael Cohen's records. Still, arms crossed, the president returned to some familiar ground. The real criminal is
Hillary Clinton.
The president was right to fire
James Comey.
And he mused about firing special counsel Robert Mueller.
Many people have said you should fire him.
And also,
they found no collusion whatsoever with Russia.
The president again attacked his own attorney general, Jeff Sessions.
The attorney general made a terrible mistake when he did this and when he recused himself, or he should have certainly let us know if he was going to recuse himself. And we would have put a different attorney general in. So he made what I consider to be a very terrible mistake for the country.
Well, President Trump has publicly debated firing Jeff Sessions for months. Not so for another cabinet official in the news lately, for all the wrong reasons. Scott Pruitt is the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, and he's been battered by accusations of unethical spending on security, on staff pay raises, on travel, all leading to calls for his termination from members of Congress and even from the president's own chief of staff. One of those accusations? That Scott Pruitt rented a room from an energy lobbyist for a below market rate of $50 a night in Washington, D.C. And Scott Pruitt says there was nothing wrong with that arrangement.
And I will tell you this. When you look at the issue and the facts, which most people don't, but when you look at the facts of what I leased and what I paid for, it is absolutely 100% ethical, and it was signed off and is legal.
That's Scott Pruitt defending that $50 a night housing deal in an April 4th interview with Ed Henry of Fox News. In that same interview, he deflected criticism over a pair of pay raises given to two EPA staffers, even after those raises were denied from the White House.
And look, there was authority to do it. It was not a legal issue. There was authority to do it, and it should not have been done. I've said unequivocally that what took place here should not have taken place.
Okay.
And I learned about it yesterday. I did not know about the pay raise. I did not approve the process. The process was breached by individuals here at this agency, and there's going to be accountability there. Those individuals, that should not have happened. I can't say any clearer than that.
I did not know about the pay raise, Scott Pruitt says there. Well, reporting yesterday suggests that might not be true. And the president has been defending Scott Pruitt, even as three Republicans called for him to go over the weekend. And still, Scott Pruitt remains as head of the agency most reviled by conservatives. New York Times investigative reporter Eric Lipton joins me now. Eric, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Well, Eric, another piece of sound from that Fox News interview with Ed Henry. Listen to this, because this one made news yesterday.
Why did you go around the president and the White House to give pay raises to two staffers?
I did not. My staff did, and I found out about that yesterday, and I changed it.
So somebody being fired for that?
That should not have been done.
Eric Lipton, there's Scott Pruitt saying he didn't give two staffers pay raises. Now, yesterday, a new revelation says that Trump administration officials have emails where one of those staffers went to HR at the EPA about that $56,000 pay raise and said, Scott Pruitt authorized it. Scott Pruitt knows about it. Scott Pruitt wants me to have this raise.
That's what's been reported. I actually have not seen those emails, and I've been told that that email exists and that it suggests that Pruitt himself knew that this raise was being given.
What would be the significance if, in fact, those emails are as reported?
It just shows the disingenuousness and, you know, a lack of you know, forthrightness about what has been going on. And, I mean, you know, he just continues to get himself deeper and deeper into questions that really are distractions from what is his main mission, at least according to from his appointment from the president, which is to roll back the regulatory agenda. And each of these things are not at all a part of that agenda and sort of hard to understand why they're going on.
So can you give us a sense of the overall universe of Scott Pruitt's alleged unethical behavior? We just mentioned pay raises to two staffers that Scott Pruitt wasn't supposed to sign off on. It appears maybe he did sign off on them. An apartment in Washington, a condo rental from a lobbyist, $50 a night, which is below market rate. A security detail, 19 strong, which is historically large for an EPA administrator. I don't know if I've covered the waterfront here.
Yeah, there's also the first-class travel, which he was doing, which was argued to be based on security threats, but the justification for that was unclear and very unusual to be repeatedly traveling first class or at times even on charter flights or military flights. And then, you know, perhaps most significantly was that there are at least five staffers that we've identified, as we reported last week in the New York Times, who were transferred, demoted, or voluntarily moved to other jobs after they raised objections about some of the spending or travel or issues with the amount of security. And when they raised concerns about these things, they were then essentially punished. And so that's the range of issues that have emerged. More substantively, though, I mean, he continues to try to roll back regulatory matters relating to clean air and clean water. And in at least six cases, courts have said you did that improperly and that you didn't follow the requirements of the regulations. And the courts have repeatedly told him to go back and start over again.
So, you know, Eric, I can hear you in each of these answers. Of course, it's important that we talk about ethics and ethical lapses on the part of government officials who serve the public. And I hear you pivoting each time to the environmental agenda that Scott Pruitt is supposed to be executing here, and how not only is he not doing that, he's rolling it back, which I guess is his boss's imperative, but that the courts are slapping him back as well for doing this incorrectly.
Right. I mean, I think the biggest story of the EPA is not the ethical lapses, real or unsubstantiated, regarding Scott Pruitt. And they are, as I said, a major distraction for a guy who otherwise is quite smart and, you know, proved himself as the Attorney General of Oklahoma to be pretty proficient at challenging Obama regulatory rules. I mean, but again, the real story is his effort to roll back the Obama environmental agenda. But in neither category of his activity are things going well right now.
Well, I wonder if one of those two categories helps explain the other. You know, other cabinet officials have been let go for lapses seemingly less serious than all of Scott Pruitt's. Tom Price over at HHS was fired after lavish travel accusations. Scott Pruitt already has those, all these other ethical lapses alleged, and there's evidence of some of them, and yet he remains. Why is that? Is he so popular with the right and his regulatory rollback agenda that he's surviving here? What do you make of it?
I think that there's some pretty good evidence that that is the case. And there are a variety of groups out there that are campaigning for Trump not to fire Pruitt. And there are, you know, conservative groups, there are dark money groups. And it seems as if the industry quite likes, that is the oil and gas and coal and other regulated industries, the auto industry, they like all of these regulatory rollbacks that Pruitt is doing. And Trump, in fact, is being pressured to keep Pruitt. And then to some extent as well, you know, the EPA and the Department of Interior, if there are two agencies that are the most effective in terms of actually doing something substantive during the Trump administration relative to rolling back rules, it's those two agencies. So you're going to be reluctant to fire the guy who is most effectively carrying out your agenda, even if he's got ethical issues on the margins, and particularly in an administration where ethical issues on the margins seem to be pretty normal.
Well, Eric, here's another little piece of sound from that Fox News Ed Henry interview that Scott Pruitt did that might shine some light on this.
And anytime that you do transformational things, there are critics and there are people that come against you in that regard.
Now, that's a brief clip, Eric Lipton, but Scott Pruitt seems to be suggesting that he's so darn effective as an anti-regulator that people are out to get him.
I think that's true. I mean, the Fire Pruitt campaign going on right now from the environmental groups is another reason why perhaps Trump would not fire Pruitt, because, you know, the environmental groups are running advertisements pushing Trump to fire Pruitt. And, you know, it's just like, of course, the president is going to do the opposite when he's got his liberal enemies pushing him to do something. And I guess on this front, I agree with Pruitt. He has become an incredible, you know, source of anger by the left, and the left wants him out. And they are attacking him with quite an incredible intensity. But the problem is that he keeps fumbling. I mean, all of these things we're talking about, his ethics, are unforced errors, and they're dumb. I mean, I don't understand why a guy as smart as Pruitt would have made as many ethical mistakes as he's made that's put him in the trouble that he's now in. He's done it himself.
Well, let's not you and I bother trying to get inside Scott Pruitt's head. The EPA Inspector General has 5 separate investigations into his ethical practices already. Talk about those.
Yeah, the Inspector General is looking at his travel, at expenses relating to the sound booth that he put into his office for security purposes. And there have been requests that they also look at the condo and the rental of that condo from the wife of an energy lobbyist. So there are multiple reviews going on. It's unclear where the Inspector General will end up. And even if the Inspector General finds that he did things wrong, they don't have the power to remove him. It's really the president that would have the power to remove him.
So where do you think this goes in a divided Washington for a guy like Scott Pruitt?
At a certain point, this just becomes too much of a distraction. And it, you know, Trump doesn't like attention taken away from him or his agenda. That, to me, is, you know, the time at which he would be cut off. If it goes on so long and becomes such a severe distraction. I mean, of course, there are lots of distractions in this administration. But, you know, it's impossible to predict how anything is going to turn out in Washington nowadays. And it would be ridiculous to try to say this is what's going to happen in the Pruitt's case.
Eric Lipton with The New York Times. Eric, always great to have you.
Thank you.
Well, the nation will be watching Capitol Hill today and tomorrow. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg testifies before lawmakers about how Cambridge Analytica was able to get the personal data of nearly 90 million Facebook users. And Zuckerberg has already said that Facebook made big mistakes. Well, tomorrow we're going to be talking about your personal data and what Facebook does and doesn't have. And if you're concerned about your data, we want to help. Go to our Twitter and Facebook pages, and at the top of both of those pages, we have instructions on how you can download your data. Do it today and have your data handy with you when you listen tomorrow, because we'll explain what you're looking at and how to better protect yourself if you're worried about who's looking at the data that Facebook has collected about you. Again, go to our Facebook or Twitter page for instructions on how you can download your data from Facebook. This is The Takeaway. Residents of Puerto Rico marked 200 days since Hurricane Maria over the weekend. Months after the storm, life for many people is still difficult, and it's also violent. In the first 11 days of 2018, 32 people were killed in Puerto Rico, double the number of murders from the same time period the previous year. Now, that homicide count has risen to nearly 200 to this date. It's a pace of around 2 murders per day on average for an island about the size of Connecticut. And while many people are pointing to the storm as the reason for the violence, Nick Brown, who's Puerto Rico correspondent for Reuters and former San Juan bureau chief, says the homicide rate points to a crime problem that predates the storm.
There is a bit of a spike there, but not as big a one as you would think. So about 200 so far this year and about 180 to this date in the last couple of years. To the extent that there is a bit of a spike, a lot of it is attributable to a kind of police strike that we saw early in the year, in which police officers who were upset that they weren't getting paid OT, staged a kind of a walkout where they called in sick in the thousands. And the murder rate spiked quite a bit during that time. That has settled down a bit, and it's over now. But the thing to realize, storm or no storm, the murder rate in Puerto Rico is quite a bit higher than I think a lot of folks realize, and higher than all but a few major U.S. cities.
Well, homicides and violent crime are down in most parts of the mainland, a long trend, decades long, of less violent crime in America. What's behind the higher rate in Puerto Rico, though?
Well, for one thing, it is a very poor island, and its infrastructure is pretty bad there, and that's going to lead to people looking, you know, outside the system to survive and to make money. It's going to lead to a culture of drug trafficking. It's also geographic, though. Drug trafficking has been an enormous problem in Puerto Rico for a long time, because Puerto Rico is kind of the ideal avenue for drug traffickers trying to get product into the mainland. Once, you know, drugs come into Puerto Rico, they don't have to go through customs once they get to the mainland, because Puerto Rico is a U.S. territory. So despite all this talk of Mexico and building the wall, you know, cocaine trafficking through Puerto Rico has actually quintupled in the last decade or so. And a piece of that may be because of increased supply. A piece of it may be because the crackdown on the U.S.-Mexico border is actually pushing traffickers to find new avenues. I think, you know, law enforcement agents are still trying to get a handle on that and still looking into it. But whatever the cause may turn out to be, the fact is that cocaine trafficking through Puerto Rico is on the rise, and violence along with it.
How does this impact daily life for people in Puerto Rico? You spend a lot of time in San Juan and on the streets there and in other cities and towns across the island as well. Does it feel like an island under siege, or not so much?
Lately, although there's been a sense of normalcy start to return, and that's true, you can drive in Puerto Rico now and kind of fool yourself into thinking things are normal. Aesthetically, it looks a lot like it did before the storm now, and the restaurants are open, and most of the police are back, and a lot of people that you speak to may say it's starting to feel normal again. But for others, and I think this is especially true of those who left the island, they're simply not ready to trust that. Even if data suggests that things are getting back to normal and that crime is perhaps being more contained again, they're not ready to trust that. This was a traumatic event. You know, make no mistake, this was a trauma. So for people who left the island, their most recent memories of the island are of this suddenly dark and unsafe place. And that's one of the biggest challenges, I think, for the local government there is in drawing people back to the island, is how do you overcome that fundamental psychological sense of insecurity?
Nick Brown, Puerto Rico correspondent for Reuters. Nick, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Todd.
Let's stay in Puerto Rico now, where since May of 2017, the island has lost nearly 39,000 students. That's according to Puerto Rico's Department of Education. And half of the island's schools are at 60% capacity. Now, those numbers, according to officials, are driving a major cut in the island's education system. Late last week, Puerto Rico's education department announced that 283 public schools will close this summer. That's about one quarter of the island's 1,100 public schools. But there are other changes happening in the school system, driven, it seems, not by migration, but by ideology. So says Rima Brucey, a writer and education advocate from Puerto Rico who teaches at Lehman College in New York. Rima, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So schools closing, Rima, before and after the hurricane. The Secretary of Education, Julia Kelleher, is pushing reforms through the legislature in Puerto Rico. What's the broader picture of what's happening to the island's education system right now?
Yes, the broader picture is important because it suggests that the logic of school closings goes way beyond migration or a reduction of the student population. Basically, she's announced these closures, but she has also pushed this bill that was recently signed into law. It's called the Educational Reform Bill. And this bill is explicitly described as a school choice bill. And the two main pieces of this bill are school vouchers and charter schools, right? This is the first time Puerto Rico is going to have charter school in its history, and the first time it's going to have school vouchers in its history. So evidently, there's an expectation that students are going to be moving from public school to private school, right? So then the logic of school closings has to go beyond migration.
Now, you're talking about two very controversial aspects of education reform. Charter schools, less so. Vouchers, certainly extremely controversial. People might ask, why is now the time, when Puerto Rico's in crisis, to implement such divisive reforms?
Yes, and charter schools are also very vaguely defined in the bill. in the absence of clear explanations from the Secretary of Education as to why charters and why vouchers and why now, people can't help but speculate about the possibility of very powerful interests driving both school closures and the contents of this bill. A closed school, for example, was already rented to a powerful evangelical church to open a private Christian school, and the rent is $1 a month. Some of the schools that are going to be closing are near the beach in areas that are being heavily gentrified, because a lot of Americans from the mainland are moving to Puerto Rico to take advantage of tax exemptions. And they are moving especially into these areas that are close to the beach, and they are buying a lot of property there.
But if reformers are pushing bills through the legislature, Rima, how was the public education system doing before?
Well, the public education system had performance issues. A lot of the schools were technically low performing according to federal law, right? Partly probably because the teacher salaries in Puerto Rico are so low, and because of underfunding and because of very high poverty levels. 80% of the students in the public school system live under the poverty level. So there's this pattern, right, of moving services from the public sector to the private sector in Puerto Rico, and the education, what's happening in education, is part of that larger pattern. So it's not really a response to migration, I don't think.
Well, you mentioned more religion-based schools, privatization of some schools, charters and vouchers. Betsy DeVos at the Department of Education, I think, would like what she sees if she looked at Puerto Rico. Has she said anything?
Well, this bill, this educational reform bill was created, written in close collaboration with DeVos's Department of Education. And yes, I'm sure that she and her group of collaborators, they love what's going on in Puerto Rico, because it is pretty much the same agenda that they're trying to push at the federal level, but with much less friction, because Puerto Rico is right now under the control of a fiscal control board established by Congress, which pretty much has absolute powers over Puerto Rican financial decisions, right? Because we're under the control of the board, Puerto Ricans cannot resist or push back against this reform in the same way they can push back in the states. So this is basically educational reform DeVos style on steroids.
Writer and education advocate Rima Brusi, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Got a comment for the show? Hit us up on our Facebook page, tweet us at The Takeaway, or leave us a voicemail at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Your ideas and takes are a huge part of who we are. Let us know what you're thinking about. This is The Takeaway.
The NBA's regular season ends tomorrow night. The Toronto Raptors will finish first in the East. The Houston Rockets are number one in the West, and they'll both start the very long road of the NBA playoffs later on this week. In the NFL, protest dominated a lot of the headlines during last season. In many ways, the league struggled with how to handle protesting players and all that criticism from President Trump. Well, not so in the NBA. Players have used their platforms in basketball to mount protests all over the league, and they've been boosted by their teams. Dave Zirin is here with us. He's sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Dave, great to have you.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, Dave, it was just a few weeks ago after the shooting death of Stephon Clark in Sacramento that you wrote that Black Lives Matter had collided with the NBA in Sacramento. And protesters in Sacramento came out and shut down an NBA game. You wrote about it. This is the most recent major example of activism coming to the NBA.
That's right. And one of the things about the Black Lives Matter protesters in Sacramento that they were able to do is also connect with the players and with the team. They were able to affect the consciousness of the NBA through their actions. Had a really, really interesting ricochet effect. I mean, first and foremost, you had the players themselves wearing T-shirts calling for police accountability in the death of Stephon Clark. Then you had the Sacramento Kings and the Boston Celtics actually film a public service announcement calling for accountability.
This is bigger than basketball.
Change can be uncomfortable.
Change is necessary. We need to talk.
We need to act.
Where one player, Al Horford, referenced Fox News and said, we will not shut up and dribble. so a statement that they have a right to speak out about these issues. And this was followed up by rallies that were held by Black Lives Matter that were attended by some people connected with the Sacramento Kings, including a guard named Garrett Temple. And I interviewed the founder of Black Lives Matter Sacramento, a woman named Tanya Faison. And what she said was, I said, look, we've been working on issues like this in Sacramento for 3 years. This one just happened to connect, and it just showed that we've reached a boiling point here in the city.
Dave, so many interactions out of the tragic death of Stephon Clark with these players, and so different from the protests and the way they emanated out from the NFL in the last 18 months. I mean, it's just remarkable.
It's very different in the NBA than the NFL, and we could look at numerous reasons why that's the case. But the number one reason, I believe, is that the NBA commissioner, Adam Silver, has worked closely with the head of the NBA Players Association, Michelle Roberts, to make sure that players know that they are supported if they want to make statements like the Sacramento Kings did. I mean, think about what the Kings did. They had a PSA that played on the Jumbotron of their stadium. They had the owner of the team, a man named Vivek Randhive, who spoke in solidarity with the protests the night that they shut the fans out of the arena. There is no way that happens in the National Football League. And because the National Football League is so top-down, so authoritarian in terms of its approach to players, that the players have felt like they've had to actually rebel in the one space where their helmets are off, which is during the national anthem.
And what about the president and his approach to these protests? I mean, everyone remembers the way it went down in the NFL and the president capitalizing on that situation to rally his supporters against take any protests in the NFL. He hasn't done so with the NBA, but it doesn't mean he hasn't had something to say about players.
Well, the one thing that Donald Trump has done is withdraw any invitation to the Golden State Warriors from visiting the White House after they won a championship last year. But this was done after it became very public that the Golden State Warriors almost certainly would not accept an invitation from the White House. And Donald Trump has largely steered clear from the NBA. He hasn't responded on Twitter, as he does to so many people, to coaches like Greg Popovich and Steve Kerr, who've spoken out against him. He did not respond to LeBron James for calling Donald Trump a bum, very famously. That made the cover of the New York Times. And the reasons why I think Donald Trump takes such a wide berth from the NBA is that there's no way to reframe those kinds of protests. Like with the NFL, Donald Trump is able to say, look at them, they're not patriotic. Look at them, they hate America. And what they're trying to do is to have a discussion about Black Lives Matter. They're trying to spark a debate about police killings. And in the NBA, because they're not doing the anthem protest, it gives Donald Trump less of a space for him to reframe those protests to be about something that they're not.
And still, at times it can seem, Dave, that it's kind of capricious which tragedies spark outcry from players and which don't. In your reporting, what determines whether famous players decide to get involved in an issue or join a protest? When do they decide to do it?
There are two big factors that I've identified, and I've studied this pretty close, because what you're asking is kind of the question. Why? And it's not just a question about sports. It's a question about our society, because there have been, I believe, 115 police killings in the last month. Why do one or two of these spark this kind of outcry? And when it comes to professional athletes, it's really two things. The first, quite obviously, is video. When there is video that's released of these killings, when people can actually see them and they get circulated on social media, it's able to break the highly constrictive bubble that so many players have to live in by necessity of being a professional athlete, where everything is about training and food and even monitoring your sleep heart rate to gain optimal performance. And the video is a huge factor. The second factor is if it happens in a player's hometown. Matt Barnes, for example, who we mentioned before, is from Sacramento. That has a huge impact. Also, Sacramento is a very small town, so people who have played there feel a sense of connection to the community.
Well, Dave, the long slog of the NBA playoffs are coming up later on in the spring here. We don't know exactly what's going to happen, but it's a huge platform. Are you going to be surprised to see protest be a part of the playoffs and the finals?
I think that's going to be entirely affected by what happens outside the arena, what happens with the police. I mean, that's the thing that we've learned, is that athletic protest is not the engine of what happens. It's the reaction to what happens. So if there are protests, if there are more high-profile police shootings like we just saw in Brooklyn this past week, then you will see protest. Without that, I don't think you will.
Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation magazine, host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Dave, great to have you.
Oh, thanks so much, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. Over the last few weeks, we've been bringing you stories of women initially passed over by the obituary section of the New York Times. The Times Overlooked Project is giving obits to great women in history who never got them until now.
Get the motor run.
Well, today, the story of a woman who roared across America on her Harley.
She was the motorcycle queen of Miami.
Bessie Stringfield was a black woman with a passion for riding at a time when you didn't see many women of color on a bike, and a lot of people didn't want to. But Bessie defied convention. She was often the only woman among men, like when she served as a motorcycle dispatcher in World War II. Eventually, she settled in Miami.
She was this incredible woman who, at a time when many women were at home or worked as domestics, she decided that she wanted to ride motorcycles.
That's New York Times reporter Nikita Stewart there. She's written a new obituary for Bessie Stringfield, who died in 1993. And Nikita tells us how Stringfield became an important symbol in her time.
Bessie Stringfield was very much a lady, if you will. She always had her hair done. She, you know, wore these beautiful outfits. Some folks could see her as a tough biker chick, which is definitely the wrong way to put it, because she believed in these Southern manners, and that's how she presented herself on the motorcycle, a lady with her hair whipping through the wind underneath her helmet.
Now, we're not just talking about the streets of Miami and Miami Beach, right? I mean, Bessie Stringfield got out of the city and rode her bike all over the South, which was nothing small for a black woman to be doing.
No, it wasn't. So imagine at that time, even before she settled in Miami, being a woman in the 1940s and 50s and being a black woman at that, riding through the South and all over the United States at a time when the roads were not paved. You know, people complain about potholes today, but there were a lot of roads that were unpaved. And she was out there doing her thing, sometimes by herself. And according to her, she ran into some troubles, mobs of people who didn't like the color of her skin, you know, men who didn't think that she should be riding. But she fought against all of those odds and did what she loved, which was riding motorcycles.
Bessie Stringfield, before she took to a Harley around the South, was also a veteran of World War II.
Yes. Well, there are some discrepancies. Some stories say that she was actually a civilian dispatcher for the Army. We can't be sure because those records actually don't exist anymore. There was a fire. You wouldn't believe what I had to do to try to track down the true story of Bessie Stringfield. In working on this story, I found that some of the stories of her origin were not accurate. She told people that she was originally from Jamaica and that she had been abandoned on a Boston street and adopted by a benevolent white woman. And that story turned out was not true. She was actually from North Carolina, and I had the good fortune of tracking down her nieces and nephews who could remember her, you know, whirling into town. They lived in Baltimore at the time, and, you know, taking them for rides on her motorcycle. And her family was horrified that a woman would be riding motorcycles the way she did.
Did she ever talk about what the bike meant to her? I mean, the cliche, of course, it's even in the Harley commercials, right? A motorcycle means freedom, the open American road, leaving your past behind, all of those things. Did Bessie ever talk about what the bike meant to her?
It really was about freedom. Even though she did not present herself as, I guess, a black pioneer, if you will, or she didn't want to be relegated necessarily to the first black this, the first black that, it was a different kind of freedom, because it was not only about being on the open road, but it was about being on the open road as a black woman doing something that most people could not do and would not do.
Talk a little bit more about her notoriety during her life at the time. I mean, was she well known locally in Miami? Did people see her ride and say, oh, there goes Bessie, as she rode by?
Yes. You know, there was an annual parade in Miami. Black universities would have a football game, and that football game included a well-attended parade. And she was in that parade every year, and so many children were just inspired by her. Little girls who were like, oh my goodness, look at that motorcycle, and oh my goodness, that's a woman. And, you know, that was her, you know, real impact. What's interesting, though, is that when she wasn't on her motorcycle, she led a very ordinary life. She had worked as a housekeeper. She decided that she no longer wanted to be a housekeeper, and she became a certified nursing assistant. And she worked until, you know, practically her dying day. And she would ride her motorcycle to work. She would ride it to church. And, you know, it was unusual to see a 70-something-year-old woman riding on her motorcycle to church. I also interviewed two men who were now, they remembered her when they were little boys, and she worked for their family. And one day, their mother did not pick them up from school. And so Bessie came to the rescue, and she showed up at the school on this Harley Davidson. And you can imagine, it was the 1950s and it was Miami, so the city was still segregated. And these two white boys are waiting for someone to come pick them up. And here comes Bessie roaring on her motorcycle. And they were just so impressed. They still have not forgotten it. And everyone in the school cheered. They were all standing outside as these boys, you know, got on this motorcycle with this woman who was in charge of taking care of them.
Mom, never come pick me up again. Forget to get me tomorrow.
Right. Actually, their mother was not very happy. She was very upset. It was basically, why didn't you just take the car? But that's not how Bessie rolled.
Nikita Stewart for the New York Times, writing the obituary for Bessie B. Stringfield, the motorcycle queen of Miami, for the New York Times Overlook Project. Nikita Stewart, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Well, which women do you think have been overlooked in history?
My name is Carolyn, and I'm calling from San Francisco. And hands down, I believe that there should be more attention given to Belle da Costa Green. She was the first librarian, curator, and eventually the director of the Morgan Library. What the New York Library has today is because of her. She was a woman of color who wielded power in both social circles and academic art circles. She must have been just an extremely brilliant woman.
Hi, this is Greg from Munaki, and I'd like to nominate Rosalind Franklin, because Rosalind Franklin played this just vital role in the discovery of DNA as Watson and Crick, but she's often overlooked because of her early death and because of her gender. If it wasn't for her and her contributions, we wouldn't have the understanding of modern genetics and the medicine that we have today. So she definitely deserves to be recognized. Yay, Rosalind Franklin.
Julie, I am from the Bronx in New York City, and I'm nominating Dorothy Height. And while her name is recognizable, many of her accomplishments are not. during the height of the civil rights movement, HITE organized Wednesdays in Mississippi, which brought together Black and white women from the North and South to engage in dialogue about relevant social issues. Dorothy HITE is quoted as saying, "I want to be remembered as someone who used herself and anything she could touch to work for justice and freedom. I want to be remembered as one who tried."
This is Carrie Craven calling from San Diego, California. Amelia Boynton is someone I only recently learned about, who I think deserves more attention, to the civil rights leader who I think registered more people than anyone else in her long life to vote. And she also hosted a lot of meetings at her home with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and others. And I just love highlighting that way of being involved and supporting a movement, being a host and making space that's safe and productive, which I feel like women are often talented at doing.
This is Lisa calling from San Rafael, California. I would vote for Emma Goldman, anarchist and general purveyor of civil disobedience. I think it's important that when girls today hesitate to break from mandatory primness, that they know there have always been wild women.
The woman that is hardly known about in history is a Celtic queen in 60 AD, Boudica. She deserves to be recognized for her courage and intelligence in winning two major battles against the Romans, because all we ever hear or read about in history books is how skilled and ruthless the Roman soldiers were. But never that a woman, a Celtic queen, won two major battles against them.
Queen Boudica of the Celts, 60 AD. That's a new one for the Overlooked Project. We've been getting so many nominations from you for women overlooked by history and by the obituaries. And that's all for us today. Thanks so much for being with us this hour. I'm Todd Zwillich. This is The Takeaway.